everybody. We're back. Yes, we're back with a brand new episode of A Journey Through Stock Aitken Waterman. Since you last heard from us, Matt's been off in Africa. Welcome home, Mr. Denby.
Thanks, Gavin. Yeah, I've been having a great time in Kenya over the past few weeks, hanging out with elephants and monkeys and zebras and seeing what it's like to not be at the top of the food chain for once. And on that point, Gavin, I can confirm that when you encounter a lion on foot, it definitely does change the way that you see life. But it's great to be back here with you all to talk about SOAR, and this episode we've got some pretty big tracks to discuss.
Yes, now all our various holidays are behind us, we can go full steam ahead. So let's crack on with the singles we have this episode, which include two UK number one hits and a firm fan favourite. Up first, the latest chart topper from Jason Donovan. This is Sealed With A Kiss. Just as Rick Astley had followed two upbeat singles with a ballad remake, so too did Jason with his version of Sealed With A Kiss following Nothing Can Divide Us and Too Many Broken Hearts, in terms of his solo singles. Ballad duet, especially for you, had done so well, so this seemed like a no-brainer on all fronts.
Yeah, the chart positions tell their own story. As well as knocking another SOAR track, Ferry Cross the Mersey, from the top spot in the UK, this was also a massive hit around the world, hitting number one in Ireland, eight in Australia, two in Belgium and Finland, three in Portugal and four in Germany. This track really suits Jason's vocal range, being a lot less demanding on him than SOAR's pop dance material. There are notably no serious bum notes here, and this track has worked repeatedly for various artists down through the years. Let's have a listen to its rather remarkable musical history.
Though we gotta say goodbye for the summer, darling, I promise you this.
I'll send you all my love every day in a letter sealed with a kiss. Yes, it's gonna be a cold, lonely summer, but I'll feel the emptiness. I'll send you all my dreams every day.
Okay, that was, in order, the Four Voices, who recorded Sealed With A Kiss first in 1960, but they didn't have a hit with it. Then there was Brian Hyland's 1962 cover, which reached number three in both the UK and the US. And Brian's version also returned to the UK top 10 when it was re-released in 1975. Next was a remake by Gary Lewis and the Playboys, which made the US top 20 in 1968, as did the final version we heard by Bobby Vinton from 1972. Now, Bobby's was the most successful recording in Australia prior to Jason. It reached number 9. And those records are all fairly similar to each other and to Jason's update. But American girl group The Toys took the song in a very different direction in 1968, around the same time as that Gary Lewis cover, and they made the Australian top 50 with this.
Right, that was a brand new listen for me, and I think it's a lot of fun. There's a bit of proto-disco energy in there, and I'd definitely play that one again.
Yeah, I'd never heard that one before either, and I have to say, it's pretty good.
With this song being covered successfully so many times, it has a timeless quality that gives it a lot of cross-generational appeal. Jason had this to say on the subject when he spoke to Smash Hits back in 1989. I had a conversation with Pete one day in the car on the way to the Cotswolds to see his collection of cars, and I said to him, I wanted to do something that was slower because it was such a dance LP. The song wasn't my suggestion, it was Pete's idea and another guy who works at PWL, Tilly. That would be Rutherford.
Ah, yes, Tilly Rutherford. If you're listening, get in touch. We'd love to have a chat. Now, I've always been interested in what the strategy was here, not only with Jason, but with what I call the jukebox era cover versions that SOAR produced for their young artists. To me, a song like Sealed With A Kiss was really dated, and it was produced in a style that didn't really bring it forward to fit in with the new era in the way that Toys version did. So who better to ask about the thinking behind this A&R decision than David Howells, who was directly involved with Jason's career at PWL.
The one thing with great cover songs is even if the audience is too young to know the song, the public have the ability to recognize a hit. It's an uncanny thing. I mean, they just go, that's great, and buy it. They don't necessarily know the artist who did the original. They don't necessarily know the genre. They don't know the period. They just go, I like that. You're looking for success. You're looking to connect with an audience. You're looking to give the audience what they want. Our philosophy at PWL was give the audience what they want, but at a better quality than they expect. And that's a pretty unbeatable combination. And so the cover songs, it's a song is a song is a song. And more importantly, a hit is a hit is a hit.
Compared to something like Venus, which fitted in with what was happening musically in the mid-80s, it was high energy, it was definitely a 1980s track. Jason's version of Sealed with a Kiss probably could have come out in the 60s. I mean, yes, the instrumentation was different.
Of course.
So was there any concern in making Jason seem too dated?
But the public don't see them as dated. It's a brand new audience. They're seeing this as a fresh new song. They have no prejudices. They're not making any judgments. They're just going, either I like it or I hate it. But in most cases, they instinctively know it's a hit. And that's all that matters to them. They don't make those judgments, or the adults make the judgments.
Part of me always suspected that it was, okay, well, let's put this out. As you've said, the kids won't know the original, but they love Jason, so they'll love it, and it's a good song. Their parents will remember the original. They might not like Too Many Broken Hearts, but they'll like this. Is it kind of the let's broaden his appeal, let's make him cross-generational with a song like this? I mean, was there any strategy to this, or was it just it's a good song, it's a good cover, let's get him to do it?
It's not, it's just a good song. It is a hit song, and this is what he needs to do right now. And then you have further success. It's what we were about. We were about making success and making successful artists. Most record companies thought they were selling pop records to teenagers. They're not selling records to teenagers. They're selling records to children between the ages of 3 and 11. That was the audience. Other people then, the older brother and sister, the parents, the relatives, might buy them that as a gift for a birthday or a Christmas or something special. And they may go, oh, I really love this. Isn't this great? But they're not going to be converted to being fans. The audience is very young. And it's very demanding, and they know exactly what they want. Are there some 12, 15-year-olds that buy their records? Of course there are. Are there some 25-year-olds? Yes, but the audience is 3 to 11. That's what drives these records.
Right, interesting. Now, I agree with David that the public will often recognise and immediately plug into a high-quality legacy track without necessarily knowing much about the era that it came from or even the original artist. And there's something still immediately appealing about this song. Even though the passage of time has made certain elements, like the overt sappiness of the lyrics, a bit dated to modern ears. I did always think, though, that these covers were a deliberate way of expanding the buyer base by hooking in the nostalgic mums and grandmas as well. When you get those people in, you can really get a massive mega hit.
Now, it seems Jason was right on board with doing a cover, even if he wasn't familiar with Sealed with a Kiss before it was presented to him. He told Duke magazine in June 1989, quote, I had the idea of doing a cover, and what I wanted to do was try and broaden my audience a little. When I was a kid, if my parents liked a song that I liked, it made it extra special. And I thought, well, it'd be great to have a song that I like, that they like as well, and that the kids out there, when they buy it, they kind of go, wow, that's great too. When he was questioned about the song's lyrics by the interviewer, Byron Smith, who thought they were corny, Jason had this to say, quote, When you think about it, if you strip everybody back to what they are, that's what everybody's about, no matter who they are. Politics and society and the environment is great, and I believe there should be causes for that, and I'm all for the causes. But at the end of the day, what's something that we all do, and that's love. Have love or relationships with other people. And what I want to sing about is that, because I know that everybody out there can relate to that.
Well, the target audience adored this record and what it was saying, and this track helped push the 10 Good Reasons album on to be the biggest selling UK album of 1989. Wow. So Jason was really on fire here, but so was the PWL strategy for him. Things were a bit different down here in Australia, where Jason was suddenly no longer a regular face on TV. The song was his last major hit here and his second to last top 40 solo entry. So in sharp contrast to the UK, Sealed With A Kiss was pretty much his swan song as a pop star down under.
Okay, so that's what Jason thought of Sealed With A Kiss, but what about Mike Stock, who had to put it together with Matt Aitken? Was Mike behind the idea to do a cover? Let's find out. You said the last time we spoke that you were generally happy to do a remake because it made the process quicker, you didn't have to write a song, but how did you feel about remaking a ballad like Sealed With A Kiss?
Well, I felt okay with Sealed With A Kiss. I didn't, I could sort of vaguely remember the original, and we set about... Well, that's to say Matt and me putting a backing track down, and we more or less copied the original, even the tempo of the original. But I recorded the vocals for Jason out in Melbourne. I flew out for that and for other songs on the album. And when I got it back to London, I'm sitting with Matt and we realised it's far too slow. I can't remember what the original was, but it's really slow. And I very sped it up by about 6%. That, which is an amazing amount, but when you start it off at 70 beats a minute, it doesn't make a lot, major difference. But I mean, if you were 120 and you very sped up 6%, you'd be going up to near 130. It would make a massive difference. And I don't know whose idea it was to do it. It's probably Waterman, you know, who thought, or possibly David Howells, who felt Brian Hyland, was he a bit of a heartthrob? I don't know.
Yeah, it did seem to be channeling that, I guess, in the same way that Rick had done When I Fall in Love. And then, of course, you had Tears on My Pillow, End of the World, Hey There, Lonely Girl. It became a bit of a thing.
Yeah. And I didn't mind that. Like I'd said, I didn't mind the fact that I don't have to write a song today. Somebody else has done that work. Because that is always the difficult bit. Always, well, it's not difficult. It's the emotional stress. Because if you're, Donna Summer's coming in, you're going to sing her your tune. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to have to sing this idea I've got to Donna Summer.
But did you like doing that series of covers? It felt like a series, those 50s and 60s jukebox covers from When I Fall in Love all the way up to Hey There, Lonely Girl. Were you kind of okay doing them, or were you a bit like, oh, here we go again, here's another oldie?
Yeah, I don't remember being asked what songs to choose if we were going to do covers. I think they were made, other people just, in a way, I could do it now in a way, Gavin. I could say to myself, right, Kylie, I've always fancied this song from 1930. It's a great little tune, you know. Just because I love that song, I should get Kylie to sing it. You know, I suspect that's what was happening with David Howells and Pete Waterman. They've always loved it, so wouldn't it be good to get one of the acts to do it? I didn't, as long as they were good songs, I didn't really have a view.
It's true. Sealed With A Kiss is so slow. When I made my Jason music video compile for social media, I could only fit in him singing the title compared to a couple of lines of other hits. And I will confess, I didn't like this song at all at the time. As well as being slow, I found it dated and daggy. Like When I Fall in Love, this wasn't what I wanted from a pop star at the time. That said, I actually don't mind it now, and I think it suits Jason, as you said, vocally pretty well. I'd go so far as to say it's my favourite of that string of jukebox covers, and maybe it's because I'm now daggy and dated.
Well, I agree that this track nails the genre, and like you, I think it's the best of that run of drippy Saw covers, maybe with the exception of Tears on My Pillow, but that could just be the Kylie factor clouding my view. When you think of the height of 1989 Jason Donovan mania, you usually think of either this song or Too Many Broken Hearts. It's really one of his hallmarks. While this record wasn't for me, and Jason wasn't for me as a pop idol, much more on that in this episode's bonus material, I see how perfect this song was for his market. It's a swoon fest perfectly suited to Jason's core fan base of younger girls who were just as much buying the dream of Jason, the boyfriend.
Yeah, if you were putting together a template for a teen male heartthrob, you really need to look no further than this single, Do You? No wonder those female fans worked themselves up into such a jars of breath buying frenzy.
Yeah, right. Jason's swoon worthiness was played to the hilt in the video, which featured him singing dreamily to the camera, lit by a campfire on that strangely fake beach. And this video was intended as the first part of an ongoing story, but we'll get to that in the Everyday episode.
We sure will. Now, this video definitely had the feel of one of those beach parties party movies that Cliff Richard and Elvis Presley starred in when they were just starting out. And director Chris Langman, who we've heard from on the show before, told us that the reason it was shot in a studio, that fake beach that you mentioned, rather than at an actual beach, was due to a time crunch. He didn't have Jason for long, and he had to film it near where Jason was working on something else, and there was no time to get him onto an actual beach. The video also provided Sealed with a Kiss with its single cover, a situation that was also due to limited time with Jason. Let's hear from PWL stylist Sharon McPhillamy about that.
Sealed with a Kiss, he wasn't available for a photo shoot, so there were no up-to-date photos and he was too busy. So we had to take a still from the video. And that's a blooming... Have you ever tried to do that? It's very difficult to get a mouth and eyes in the right place. So I had to do that as well. That was a good fun thing to do.
You were sitting there with the video hitting pause and...
Hitting pause, yeah. With an editor, I didn't do it.
Well, you got a good shot.
Yeah, we did in the end. Mm.
Right, thanks, Sharon. Now, if we flip this single over, we've got something entirely different. It's a pretty good dance groove with very little Jason on it. Let's have a listen.
That was B-side, Just Call Me Up. And while it was No, My Arms Keep Missing You, I guess the thinking was the same. Stick an upbeat track on the flip side of the big ballad. Just Call Me Up has the makings of a good song, but with the vocals limited to just the chorus and lots of jazzy guitar in there, it ends up feeling like it could really just be called Jason's theme. It's not bad in and of itself, but it's a shame it wasn't taken further and turned into a fully fledged song for Jason, since this style of track suits him quite well. And I wonder what the story is there. I wonder if it was just a case of, okay, we haven't had time to finish the verses or whatever. Okay, just stick some guitar on it. That'll do. Anyway, good song. 10 actually fully fledged songs were put together for Jason's album 10 Good Reasons, which was rounded out to 11 tracks with the inclusion of Especially For You, which I always found a bit confusing. Was one of the tracks not a good reason? Anyway, we'll talk more about the album and count down your favourite songs from it in order in this episode's bonus material. Meanwhile, back to this episode, and one number one deserved another, with Stock Aitken Waterman hitting the top with their latest pop discovery.
Next up, we've got another number one from a previously unknown teenage artist who achieved that lofty position with her very first single. Yes, it's Liverpool's answer to Kylie Minogue, Sonia. Let's have a listen. That was You'll Never Stop Me Loving You by Sonia, which hit the UK charts in June of 89.
And not You'll Never Stop Me From Loving You, despite what the lyrics may say and what many people mistakenly call it.
Yeah, well, Sonia's rise to fame is a direct sequel to the Reynolds Girls story, albeit one involving vocal talent and a string of hits before the inevitable sad falling out. Just like those sisters, Sonia was a teen Saul fan, literally plucked from Liverpool obscurity by Pete Waterman, after she approached him begging for a chance to sing. It really feels like Pete was determined to personally discover the next crop of teen sensations for PWL. Perhaps after David Howells had changed everything by signing Kylie and Jason, he felt he had something to prove. He really was on a girl next door kick with these Liverpool signings, saying this in his autobiography. Sonia was a bubbly scouser who really wasn't so different from the audience she was playing to. She could easily have been one of the kids listening to the Radio City show, and in fact we found her when she talked her way into the radio station one day.
And to be fair, Pete could be pretty on the money when it came to plucking teenagers from up north and turning them into stars. Just look at Rick Astley. I do like the way he seems to have been quite open to chatting to all the teens who came up to him when he was out and about. Not only was it good market research, but I guess you never did know when a future chart-topping singer was going to come up to you and thrust their demo tape in your hand.
Yeah, here's Sonia's recollection of that fateful meeting, which he described to Classic Pop magazine. Quote, I met Pete Waterman at the Teenage Disco in Liverpool. I was so cheeky and determined for him to sign me up that he asked me to sing on his radio station live on there. After that, the switchboard went mad asking who I was. The rest is history.
And that history began before Sonia rocketed to number one. Her career was warmed up with a stint on the Hitman Roadshow. She even worked on the merch stall, apparently.
Yeah, I wonder if anyone listening bought a t-shirt from Sonia. And of course, back in the studio, the guys were working on a sound that would suit Sonia. One big myth we can bust right now is that her debut number one single was crafted around her persona. Apparently, she wasn't giving stalker vibes during her requisite Get to Know You meetings with Mike and Matt. Let's hear from Mike Stock now on how that song came to be.
I believe this was a situation where you had a chat with her and got to know her and then went away to write You'll Never Stop Me Loving You. Is that one of those situations where you got a sense of her and what would work?
Listen, I think Sonia has said something like that, and I don't think that's true, no. I don't know if I've actually heard her sing, but I had You'll Never Stop Me Loving You, because in the tune itself, You'll Never Stop Me From Loving You, but I dropped the syllable out for the title because it swung better. But the truth is, it's a lyric from one of the things we did to get ideas for titles. You look through, doesn't really matter, old Motown songs. You don't pick, you know, I'm not going to write a song, This Old Heart of Mine, or What Becomes of the Broken Hearted. But if you look through all the lyrics, deep inside all of those lyrics will be another line that says the same thing. And you'd find a few like that. I think You'll Never Stop Me From Loving You was probably in one of those. And that's where I started from. But realizing as I was, slowly. I hadn't worked with her. I hadn't really heard her voice, so I wasn't sure. So I was sort of making all the decisions on the day with her. And she was rushing like mad. I couldn't get her to sing in time, just enthusiasm and all the rest of it. But so I had to pull her back. And finally, she nailed it. And that's a kind of a song which could have been a Kylie song off the second album, maybe. It's also one that you can do it in a slow way.
Yes, I've heard Denise Van Outen do it.
She did a version like that. It can be pepped up or slowed down. So, and I can play it to you now on the piano. You know, I could just sit here and go, there you go, you recognise the tune, it all fits together. And she was on Chrysalis, the label, and her A&R man, Pete Robinson, to listen to the mix with me and Matt. Phil Harding did the mix, but Matt and me were in the control room down there, and Pete Robinson came in. We played it to him, and I could see him nodding away, but he wasn't sure. And then we played it to him a second time, and Matt said, "You love it, don't you? I could see you love it." And he did. He said, and he's a good guy, Pete, because he A&R'd Rick Astley for RCA. And, you know, he hears a pop song, he recognises it immediately. Because you don't forget, you've got to persuade everybody. You've written a pop song. It's not trendy. It's not this. It's not that. But it's a pop song. Has it got a tune? Has it got a melody? Can you? You've maybe got to talk to, you know, a few of the girls in the office. You've got to talk to the milkman. You've got to get somebody's, because everybody else's opinion in the music industry is shaded by other considerations. And most of the trendy guys hated everything we did about pop. And you're fighting everybody, so you have to persuade a million load of people before you can get it out, the record out there, before they'll put their money into making a video. That was half the job. That was Waterman's job.
How do you feel about its status as a stalker anthem?
Yeah, I did think about that for the set. In fact, when I was singing the chorus, one of the backing singers said to me, "Oh, don't like that. Wherever you can go, I will follow you." Yeah, but I was thinking, it's a teenage girl following her boyfriend. You know, it's not as bad as Sting.
True.
You know, Every Breath You Take, I'll Be Watching You. That was sinister, wasn't it? But this isn't sinister.
Well, Sonia doesn't have a sinister bone in her body, does she?
No, of course not. No. Lovely girl. She is absolutely gorgeous, yeah.
The most memorable part of the promo for this single was the video. It was ultra simple, just two people dancing in a room, but it did the business, especially by establishing Sonia's sunny Liverpool lass persona. She was really putting the bright in a bright young Briton. The video was so popular that Sonia's on-screen love interest, model and dancer Paul Surety, was even strongly mooted to be making his own record with Saw at one point. It never happened.
I mean, why not? They wanted to get Lino to record a track. Why not the dancer? Anyway, the thing that stands out for me in the music video is the height disparity between Sonia and Hunky Paul. The video just wouldn't be the same without him towering over her, flexing those guns. There's also a spot of jumping on each other's backs that rivals I'd Rather Jack. Of course, Sonia, who had a background in acting and had appeared on Bread, was a natural in front of the camera.
But much like the Reynolds girls, it seems that Sonia wasn't entirely happy behind the scenes, despite those big smiles. And that came to light in a 1997 interview with London's QX magazine, where she had this to say about her image and how her early career was directed. Quote, "I'm ashamed of my image at the start of my career. PWL totally styled me. Clothes, hair, what I said. But I would never turn back the clock because that was my chance. It got me into the business and gave me success. I'm sad that people didn't realise I could sing in those days. It didn't really matter who you were. Pete wouldn't let anyone sing live." Unquote. More on the dramatic culmination of that disgruntlement in a future episode.
Dun dun dun. Sonia's style was definitely on brand for PWL, even though her actual record deal was outsourced to Chrysalis Records. She was still signed by PWL in the same way Rick Astley had been with his music then coming out on RCA. We heard PWL stylist Sharon McPhillamy talk about the accessible, fun image of the artists that she worked with in the bonus episode, The Look of a Bright Young Briton. Let's hear more from her now, talking specifically about styling Sonia. What was her personal style, and did you move far away from that at all? Or?
She didn't really have a personal style. She was 18. She was just a young girl from Liverpool who, you know, hadn't had much money, hadn't had the wherewithal really to develop any kind of style. She was just young, just really young and funny and sweet and really happy just to be led and helped into her style, which was, you know, tricky because you don't want to I didn't want to impose myself on her. But it's quite difficult when you've got this blank canvas that really, she didn't have that many opinions about it. So she was happy to go along with what we did, but we did a lot of it together. I didn't gather stuff in for her. We went shopping and we went and did all that kind of stuff together. So it was more a collaboration so that she could become herself. She was really young, really, really young, and very kind of innocent. She was very naive, Sonia. I've not seen her for many years. I'm sure she's not now.
Like, part of what I think about when I think of Sonia visually, other than obviously the distinctive hair, is big earrings, big hats, and, you know, love hearts on shirts and things like that.
It was all quite twee, but, you know, that was kind of what she was like. That's what she was like. And then, you know, when we did Top of the Pops and she had the kind of glitter and stuff, that was just her because it was kind of fun and bouncy and bright. And, you know, that's just what she was like.
And I mean, we haven't really talked about accessories and things like that, but did you source earrings for her as well? And
half of them were mine. Yeah. Everybody's wardrobes got pilfered.
It seemed like Sonia was very much, oh, I like what Sonia's wearing. I'm going to go off and get something like that.
Yeah. She was really kind of the most relatable at that point because she was just an ordinary girl who had given Pete a tape. So she was like them. And they could think, well, that could be me. And it could have been.
And I want to wear what she's wearing.
And I want to, yeah, because, you know, I saw that shirt in Topshop. I can go and get that. But I'm not sure Sonia was ever anyone who who inspired followers of fashion, but they could get what she was wearing. Yeah, there wasn't much mystery about Sonia. You know, with people like Kylie, there was that kind of, she was still that kind of, she was off the telly and she had that kind of more elevated mystery, where Sonia was the ordinary girl that everyone thought she was.
So despite Sonia fitting into the clean-cut, non-threatening, non-sexualized style of PWL, a racy club mix of You'll Never Stop Me Loving You was released. Essentially, it was a mashup of the song with French Kiss by Lil Louie. The Kiss mix took the song in a very different direction, and there was a XXX Kiss mix which included some enthusiastic moaning, like this.
Oh,
right. Love that mix. It's hilarious they made a mix that was so off-brand for one of their most innocent pop stars. But this club mix is just a bit of a fun diversion. Most of Sonia's young fans probably would never have heard of it at the time. With PWL, it was always more about the pop 7-inch, and we should probably pause now to talk more about that in detail.
Indeed, I snapped up the 7-inch, the pop 7-inch, in 1989, and when I did, it came with a free Cassingle version of the song as well. I guess you could have one for home, one for the car. So I had it on two formats until I sold the cassette to someone at school. It's a very good Saw song. Once again, taking inspiration from house acts like 10 City and Inner City for the backing track in the way that Take Me to Your Heart and Hand on Your Heart had done. On top of that was a killer pop tune, which just explodes in the chorus. Sonia had the voice to deliver that, and it's almost my favourite single of hers, but it has to settle for being a very close second.
Yeah, I distinctly remember seeing and hearing this for the first time on a TV show in Australia called The Factory, and enjoying the song, but also feeling, for the very first time, a certain sense of saturation. Like suddenly there seemed to be so many Stock Aitken and Waterman records. Perhaps even too many. Can you believe it? I also didn't get why they'd signed another teen girl singer. They already had Kylie, and she was the biggest act of her kind in the world. Why would they want another? But I did really like Sonia's voice. There's no doubt at all that she did have a great set of pipes on her. And after a string of dodgy vocalists, thank God for that. Finally, someone with real talent to go with the great songs and the great production. Vocal skills aside, nothing about her made me closely connect with her on a pop star level. Good record, good vocal, but I wasn't going to be a fan like I was with Kylie. I was 17, I was getting older, while Saw were getting younger.
And it's interesting you talking about whether or not you were a fan of Sonia, and in Australia, where she did no promo that I'm aware of, it was hard to get a sense of who she was from just the video and single cover alone. She seemed fun, that's about all I could say at the time, but in the UK, her cheery, bubbly, exuberant personality became apparent from appearances on kids' TV and at the Hitman Roadshow. Now, of course, that personality would end up being lampooned by Dawn French, but more on that when we get to 1990, when that episode of French and Saunders aired. For now, though, Sonia was a blast of energy on the UK pop scene, and fans were loving it.
Yeah, as well as hitting number one in the UK, the song also reached number one in Ireland, 3 in Greece, 10 in Norway, a few other top 20s in Europe, and 29 here in Australia. So, very respectable business, but perhaps not the huge scale of international success that Big Saw Records often achieved at this point in time, especially in the larger European markets. Interestingly, Sonia's major wins would mostly be confined to the UK and Ireland. There was something about her that uniquely appealed to audiences in those countries.
Okay, so that's just the first of six Sonia singles, one of course being a duet, that we're going to talk about on this show. And while You'll Never Stop Me Loving You seemed to come together quite quickly, our next single was a track that took a long time to be released as a single in the UK. Originally appearing on Hit Factory Volume 2 in 1988 alongside Dolly Dot's What a Night as a bit of a bonus for fans, Telly My Called by Sequel had also been released that year in the US. In 1989, the song finally came out in the UK as a single with a remix and additional production by Harding and Curno. This is the water mix of Tell Him I Called. Can you pick those influences? Yes, some very strong soul-to-soul influences there. Now, I much prefer the original mix of Tell Him I Called, which we'll play in a little bit, but this remix is really good too, with its shuffling beat and those string stabs. Very much on trend for 1989, when the soul-to-soul sound was really exploding. By 1990, every second dance track was imitating that production style.
Yeah, that soon-to-be omnipresent soul-to-soul beat was a stark sign of big change in the UK pop scene, and this remix feels a bit like we're back to the days when the Saw crew seemed a lot more concerned about what was happening in the clubs. I really like this, but like you, I think I might slightly prefer the original. The soul-to-soul copycatting in the UK music scene did eventually become overwhelming, but PWL was still early enough in the game here for it to be an enjoyable remix.
Now, as I mentioned, Phil Harding and Ian Curno weren't just credited as remixes, they also were credited with additional production, a credit that didn't get handed out willy-nilly. Not that the two of them have much memory of it. Your mix feels influenced by Soul to Soul. Was that kind of the angle there?
It's everywhere from Lisa Stansfield upwards, isn't it? That took tick took.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that Soul to Soul groove and loop, a lot of people picked up on it, and us as well. Again, because it was a certain tempo. Like a lot of records we've worked on, unless I was to get it up and play it, there's very little I could say about it. It's this sort of thing, you know, no disrespect to anyone or not trying to sound big-headed or whatever. So that's the sort of gig that we would turn around in a couple of days.
Well, they may not remember much about it, but it was quite the transformation of the original version. Let's hear a bit of that.
That was Sequel's original version of Tell Him I Called, and we can confirm that that version was fairly consistent with the one recorded a couple of years earlier by Sheila Ferguson during the sessions that had also produced the original version of Always Doesn't Mean Forever.
Yeah, and can I just say it's a fantastic version, not a million miles away from what we're hearing with Sequel, but Sheila does a great job.
The song itself took inspiration from the SOS band's Just Be Good to Me, especially that dun 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 bassline.
Okay, so that's the background to the song, but let's talk about Sequel, a freestyle duo from Miami comprised of singers Angie Valaro and Maria Christensen.
I love a bit of freestyle, and Sequel were big on that scene, along with acts like Company B, Sweet Sensation, Lisa Lisa and Cult Jam, and Exposé. That sound was hugely underrated in Australia, wasn't it?
Oh, definitely. In 89, we were still fighting to hear cutting-edge dance music on the radio here in Australia, but a few freestyle influences. Once pop tracks did chart in Australia, like Pet Shop Boys' Domino Dancing and Dead or Alive's Come Home With Me Baby. PWL had also been dipping their toes in the waters with some of their so-called Miami mixes or Miami-influenced mixes, but the real deal was coming out of the US. Let's hear some of those iconic tracks from the freestyle explosion. How good were they? Let the Music Play by Shannon, Come Go With Me by Exposé, Hooked On You by Sweet Sensation, and Catch Me, I'm Falling, Pretty Poison. Thank you for indulging us with those. Anyway, now in our chat with Angie and Maria, they told us how they became Sequel and were signed to a small label, releasing songs like this debut single, It's Not Too Late. And they'll also tell us about getting snapped up by major label Capitol Records and putting out their album, which contained Tell Him I Called and this single, I'm Over You. Let's
go back to the very beginning of the Sequel story. How did Sequel form? And Angie, do you want to take this one?
Okay, so Louis Martinet put a group together called Exposé. And we are the sequel to Exposé. So he had the groups Exposé and Sequel. So that's how we got our name. They had found Maria, and then they found me. Louis had known me and decided to put Maria and I together.
And Maria, how did Louis find you?
So I was singing in a nightclub in South Florida, and Louis's friend, Frank Diaz, who worked for Pantera, just walked up to me and said, "You want to make a record?" And I was like, "Sure." Basically, that's it.
How did the two of you feel about, oh, okay, we're a duo now. Did that come together easily? Because I'm assuming you didn't know each other.
No, we did not know each other, but it kind of just happened easily. They put us together. We're like, okay, here we go. Right, Maria? I mean,
yeah, it was easy. Yeah. The song was already recorded. And actually, they put me with another girl first. And I don't know what happened to her, but she was gone and Angie came. And I was like, sure, whatever, but I liked Angie better. I shouldn't say those things, but I did.
And so the song you're talking about is that It's Not Too Late?
Yes.
Louis wrote and produced that track. What was his involvement beyond that track? Was he still involved with the group?
Yes. He had about 7 or 8 songs that he had just for us.
Yeah. And we were with him for, I guess, a couple years, and then Capitol Records signed us.
So you were on Joey Boy Records.
That's yes. Right. So Joey was a friend of Lewis's, and they had a split. So we split from Lewis and Pantera and went with Joey Boy.
It was kind of like Lewis was doing Joey Boy a favor, but they were in like the same kind of building. So we always saw Lewis. And
was that fine?
It was totally fine. Totally fine. We still see Lewis and talk to Lewis all the time.
What are your memories of those releases? You know, being on a smaller label on the freestyle scene in Miami, trying to break it. What do you remember about those days?
We worked every single weekend doing, you know, all the clubs, sometimes doing 2 or 3 shows a night because the songs kind of broke really big here in Florida. So we were always working.
Which I guess brings us to Capitol, right?
Right. Yes.
Yes. I have a funny story to tell about this. So we were invited to a big festival and there was some sort of legal trouble with Joey Boy. And they told me, you can't perform at this festival and you can't say the name Sequel. So we didn't perform, but we were invited on stage to say hi. So I went on stage and I said to the crowd, "What's our name?" And they all went, "Sequel." I go, "Say it again." They said, "Sequel." So I kind of pissed them off. But in the crowd was Capitol Records. And based on the crowd's reaction and that alone, they wanted to talk to us. And that's how we got signed.
It was a big concert with one of the radio stations down here. And yes, the crowd definitely knew who we were. And I think I got a call the next day.
That's right.
From Capitol Records.
Just from that response. So they probably looked into us and said, "What the heck?" And then figured out, well, they heard the music and figured out that we could sing and we were cute. We're still cute, but we were really cute.
And so how different was it being signed to a major label after Joey Boy? I imagine worlds apart, right?
Better food.
Absolutely. That's how we came over to England because EMI is there. And we did a whole tour in England.
Plus, we worked with Stockcake and Waterman. You know, Capitol has way more money. So we traveled and we worked with big producers. And I mean, it was like, we were so young and we were like, it was a dream come true, really.
It was, definitely.
Angie, you co-wrote a couple of singles on the album that you ended up doing with Capitol, whereas before it seems like people like Louis had been writing the songs. Was that encouraged your songwriting input or did you have to fight for that?
No, Capitol, you know, wanted that, which was great because Maria wanted to do that. I wanted to do that. And it was a lot of fun, and everything that we kind of submitted, they liked. So it was a great experience.
Once the band was signed to Capitol, the Saw connection came about, and Sequel ended up recording Tell 'Em I Called. Let's hear from Angie and Maria about that experience.
All right, Stockake and Waterman, who came up with the idea of working with them?
Our A&R person, Tim Carr at Capitol. So yes, that was exciting for sure.
How aware of who they were and what they'd done were you two?
We knew. They were very popular by that time.
We were very, very excited.
And so what was the arrangement? Was it always going to be, yep, they've got this song called Tell Him I Called? How did you arrive at doing that song?
It was, they sent us the song with the 3 Degrees singing it and said this is the song they wanted to do with us. So that's how we got Tell Him I Called.
And we loved it because it kind of sounded like Princess a little bit. Oh, I loved her. I just loved her.
We love that song because it was far away from the freestyle. It had like R&B vibes.
Pop, yeah.
We loved that song.
You're talking about Say I'm Your Number One?
Well, yes, and Tell Them I Called. They have like similar feel.
So you were aware of Princess in the US because she didn't really break there so much.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was a big fan.
I think you probably heard the Sheila Ferguson version because from what I understand, Sheila, who was one of the 3 Degrees, was leaving to go solo and she recorded
probably
Tell Him I Called with Stockake and Waterman, but it was never released.
Oh, so maybe, but it sure sounded like them, the background vocals and stuff. But
yeah, it was her.
Yeah.
Did they ever explain why that song wasn't coming out or anything like that?
No, we didn't know the backstory of why they didn't use it. We would spill the tea if we knew.
Okay, so you got the song, decided, yep, this sounds good because, and Maria, you said it wasn't a freestyle sound, so it was something different for you. And was that exciting to do a new sound?
Yes, I loved it.
Yes, it was pop. But at that time, pop wasn't really big. So, you know, we were worried about them not releasing it. Because, like I said, pop wasn't, that type of music. I guess it had that R&B feel, but we loved it.
Then did you go over to the UK to actually record it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, tell me about that experience and working with Stockake and Waterman on the track.
Okay, go ahead, Maria.
So I think it was my first time out of the US, and we were overwhelmed. I don't even know how to describe it. Like, next thing you know, we're in London. Next thing you know, we're doing a whole tour of the whole, you know, English countryside and going to crazy places like Sunderland, where they're still pulling beer in wagons with barrels. And, you know, for two girls who have never left the country, this was so crazy. You know, it's like, it was overwhelming. Fun. Super fun.
Yes. It was a lot of fun. And then we're in the studio with them, and It was fine. They were super nice, made us feel very comfortable. It went smoothly, right, Maria?
Yeah.
And it was that was that, in and out.
Right. So you got the typical Stockake and Waterman, come in, do the vocals, and off you go.
Kind of. But the thing that I remembered was that I didn't particularly like was the layering of the vocals. They were layering my vocal. Like, and if you layer somebody's voice enough, it kind of takes the character out. But they like to do that with their female artists a lot. So that's the one thing that I wasn't totally happy with.
Did you work with Mike Stock mostly on your vocals?
I think so.
I think, yes. We had practiced so much that
we were ready.
Yeah, we were ready. So it kind of just went very smoothly, you know, except we had to layer, but it just flowed.
The backing track, was the backing track essentially the same as the Sheila version?
I think so.
Yes, we were doing the background vocals too, but they left hers as well.
Was there a video? Did you film a video for the song at all?
No.
I wish. That would have been awesome.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
The only song we have for a video is I Am Over You. Actually, we did one for It's Not Too Late, but it was from kids at a college. They did it.
It was independent.
Yeah. which was really cute.
Other than the layering of the vocals, what did you think of the song?
I loved it. Loved it. Really did. I was like, oh my God, I could hear this on the radio.
How did your fans react to Telly My Call because it was a bit different?
I don't think our fans in the US heard it.
Yeah, well, the people that bought the album did, because I get quite a few, like if I post the picture, that, you know, people always say great song.
You know, I ran into one of them about 3 years ago, Stock.
Mm-hmm.
So he was at a songwriting conference that I was at. So I walked up and I said, do you remember me? And he's like, oh my God, Sequel. And I was like, wow, you have a good memory.
Another track on Sequel's album has a PWL link. The song Let It Go was remixed by Harding and Kerno. Let's take a listen.
There's a lot more to the Sequel story, isn't there? Maria went on to be involved in some other notable musical projects, and her name is connected to some big songs.
She sure did. First, she was signed as a solo artist to Atlantic Records, and then she was part of another all-female act called Third Party, who had a couple of Billboard charting singles. Can You Feel It? And Love Is Alive.
Now, Third Party also recorded the original version of a song you might be familiar with.
Yes, that's right. Maria wrote and recorded the original version of Waiting for Tonight, which of course was covered by Jennifer Lopez. Such a great song. Let's hear from Angie and Maria about their post-Sequel lives, including all those tracks we've just heard, and their eventual reunion. And so then after the album came out, what happened there?
Nothing.
Well, no, we started touring everywhere.
But the album never really took off, and I don't know why. It just seemed like none of our singles just didn't break through to pop top 40.
And so then did you decide, okay, we're done with Sequel for now and go your separate ways? What happened there?
I think it was the Capitol Records said no more. And then, yes, we did. We went our separate ways. Maria and I stayed friends, of course, throughout. And I became a mom. And Maria went on to do some things with music. We always visited, you know, we're like sisters. And I kind of followed Maria's little career in writing and was so happy for her. And because she's like a sister, it was just awesome.
I mean, that's great for a duo that's put together for you to develop that relationship.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like an arranged marriage that worked out.
All right, Maria, let's talk about Atlantic Records. You moved on to, didn't you?
Yeah, so I was approached by Rick Wake. I think it was actually at a Sequel show. And he said, call me, I want to talk to you. So, of course, I was signed to Capitol, but we could tell that Capitol was, like, we were just kind of, Sequel was losing momentum or they just were not pushing us. So I started to talk to Rick. And Rick had produced Taylor Dayne at the time, and it's crazy because I always thought that Rick would be the right producer for me because he understood that big, belty voice. And a lot of the producers of freestyle music kind of weren't doing that. But as soon as Taylor Dayne came out, I was like, okay, I think I need to work with that guy. I just remember thinking that. I had to wait to get out of my Capitol contract, but they were basically letting Sequel go. So it was a natural transition. So then he moved me to New York and signed me to Atlantic.
The singles and album you did there, I know you did the ballad, I've Got to Find a Way.
Yes. And we were begging Atlantic not to release a ballad first because Mariah Carey was so big. And I'm like, okay, how are you going to compete with Mariah Carey? But they released a ballad, which I wrote, which I love. I just didn't think that was the right way to go out of the gate since I was already known as a dance singer. So I think that was the wrong thing to do.
And then you had Just a Little Bit of Love, which I didn't realize was your song because I have the Rebecca Ryan version.
Yes, there's like three versions, me, Rebecca Ryan, and Celine Dion. But yeah, they should have led with that. I wrote that for my solo album. And Rick, when the solo album, after I was done in Atlantic, which was heartbreaking, I told Rick he could use it. So he said, I'm gonna give this to Celine and see if she likes it. I was like, sure, why not? And then she did it. So basically after that, I was considered a songwriter professional because she was the biggest selling artist, solo artist of that time. So I was like, suddenly I had a Celine Dion cut, which was crazy. Actually, though, my first cut was with a group called Eternal. So I wrote a song called Never Gonna Give You Up. And I was writing about my career. And it was funny because I was writing with these producers. And so the funny thing was, is that Rick didn't like the song. So the producer said, screw it. We're going to give it to this group we're working with called Eternal. And then they went on to sell like multi-platinum. I just kind of kept falling into stuff. You know what I mean? Things just kept happening. So strange.
And tell me about Third Party. My Love Is Love, you'd done solo, but then you did with Third Party, right?
That's right. Yeah. Oh my God, you know everything. So for Third Party, it's funny because after I lost my Atlantic deal, I was so like done with being an artist. I was like, it's heartbreaking. I hate it. It's hard. I just want to write songs now. And Rick came to me and said, I want you to be a dance artist again. I was like, get out of here. And he's like, no, I have a song for you. So I was like, oh, please, I don't want to be solo. Like, can we hire some dancers to go with me? Because, you know, it's hard being on the road by yourself. So we did. We auditioned some girls and picked two girls. And I called it Third Party because it was my third record deal. So suddenly we're all over the radio. We're all over the television. It's going crazy and the single's doing well. So Rick comes to me and says, hurry up, we need to write a dance record, you know, for A&M and a whole album. And I was like, he goes, you have a month. And I'm like, what? I have a month. So I go in the studio and I wrote Waiting for Tonight and just didn't think about it. Yeah, this is fine. You have to say, whoa, and something about the night. And that's great. And it's funny because the Third Party album has a lot of demos. Like I didn't even get to sing the real vocal. They're demo vocals. That's how fast we had to turn it out. And we turned it out and toured the country and things were going pretty well. And then the record business started getting in trouble with streaming and a lot of groups got dropped. So we got dropped.
So then how did Waiting for Tonight find its way into Jennifer Lopez's Eagerly Awaiting Hands?
Yeah. So just like Tell Them I Called, these producers are really big into recycling, you know? We have this great song. What's it doing? It's going to waste. So again, he comes to me. He says, I'm going to give this to Jennifer Lopez. How do you feel? I said, I'm not using it. Sure, fine. So he did. And the rest is history.
I mean, that sort of just must be the gift that keeps on giving, right?
Oh my God. It's like, it cracks me up because 20 years later, it's like having a kid that's famous. Everybody knows your child, you know, it's like, if I say I wrote Waiting for Tonight, there's not a single person in any country in the world that doesn't say, oh my God, I love that song. you know. So it's pretty amazing.
In Third Party, how did being in that group compare to Sequel? I mean, you must have missed Angie.
I did. I missed her. But we were in contact the whole time. So yeah. Like when I would hear that one song that was on the radio,
Can You Feel It?
Yeah. I call up Maria, oh my God, you know, so I was so, you know, equally as happy as she was.
I was like, get in here, Ange, put your spandex on. Let's do this.
And the two of you have got the, well, I don't know about the spandex, you can tell me, but the two of you have reunited in more recent years, haven't you? And Angie, can you talk to me about that?
Yes. So we have a friend, Jeff, in like, I think 2008, he had a MySpace page for Sequel. He contacted me and he said, it's so big. I'll give you the password, but blah, blah, blah. He goes, you guys should start doing shows. And I'm like, what? He goes, yes, they're coming back around again. And he was right. So we have been doing a couple of shows a year, which is great because we get to hang out together and laugh and act like kids again. And so, yep, it came back around and
two times a year.
How much attention do you get for Telly My Called and the Stock Aitken Waterman side of things? Because Saw fans are pretty full on.
We have our fans, and when I post the picture of Telly My Called, they all just say, incredible song, should have been released. And so they know it from the album, but we, like I said, we never performed it because we didn't think that it caught on with the fans. And I guess we should do that live.
We should dig that up.
We should. It would be a welcomed change for sure.
Once again, Sequel prove that the artists who didn't necessarily have the greatest success with Stock Aitken Waterman often have the most interesting stories. I wish Telly My Called had been a massive hit, but it's also kind of cool as a music fan to be in on this track that not everybody knows about.
Yeah, definitely. What a great story, and one that's not really been told anywhere before. And that's the kind of thing we love giving space to on this show.
Yes, and we have some more great stories coming up in our next episode. We're going to crack on with the rest of 1989 in a fortnight, and that's going to see us reach a Saw single I know a lot of you have been waiting for us to get to. That was pretty lame, wasn't it, Matt?
And that's all right. It's a dad joke. You're a dad. Yes, it's time for one of Saw's most controversial acts, one that even the producers themselves have spoken less than glowingly about, and that's unusual. But what a fascinating story that entails. We've also got the return of the Queen of PWL herself, so it'll be a great episode.
Until then, check out the bonus material where, as I said, we're going to go from 11 to 1 of 10 good reasons, counting down your favourite tracks. And Matt and I have voted as well, so we'll talk about what we thought of all the songs as well. You can hear that at chartbeats.com.au/saw, where you can subscribe to listen to all the bonus material. There's so much of it now, so if you haven't subscribed yet, do yourself a favour and dive right in.
And if you want to catch up with us on social media, you can find Chartbeats on Facebook and also look for Chartbeats AU on Twitter and Instagram. You can find me and my line pictures on Twitter at Mr. Matt Denby.
And some flamingo pictures.
Yes, the flamingos are pretty damn cool. I can see what John Waters liked about them.
All right, everybody. See you in a couple of weeks.
Bye.